Good morning, 7:26 a.m., 4/4/13, 4th day of April, 2013, with all the fours got in the way. 17 and a quarter minutes for the first mile, not bad. 4/4/13, April 4th, 2013. It is Thursday. It must be. It's a Thursday. So tomorrow, younger daughter comes home, but not until late in the night, like midnight. And spring break is almost over. I'm not sure elder daughter has done what she needs to do in terms of grades, homework, etc. She has a couple more days left. And I do know she's been working on her artwork. She's in AP Studio, so the artwork is important. It takes time, and she's using that time now, then it's probably appropriate. So, in yesterday's activities, I found out that the book, the math book that I was interested in, is actually in the public domain. I queried Yale University Press, permissions and rights department, and they got back to me within a couple of hours, which was sort of surprising. And they don't hold the copyright. They reverted the rights when the license to print expired in 64. So the rights reverted to the School Mathematics Study Group. And the archivist for the School Mathematics Study Group at UT Austin says there's no record in their paperwork, and it is a comprehensive archive of all their paperwork, that they ever renewed the copyright. So the book is in the public domain. I'm tempted, like I need another project, but I'm tempted to republish this book on my own. Now, the idea is that this isn't a textbook that people are going to adopt for classroom use. I very much doubt that. The Common Core curriculum movement and the politics behind textbook adoption being what they are, there's no way anybody is going to look at this textbook for a text to be adopted by a school system or even in a classroom just because new math has such a bad odor. Now, I understand why new math has such a bad odor, and the National Council on Teachers for Mathematics, who took the results from Ed Begel and the School Mathematics Study Group and turned it into a curriculum, really gutted it. That's a problem. A lot of it was programmed instruction, a lot of it was a bunch of other things that had nothing to do with the new math, but was politically expedient at the time. And as a result, all the things that made this particular book at that particular time in my life so important were removed. I wouldn't have liked it either, I don't believe, if I had my first introduction to it had been what passed for new math. Yeah, there was an emphasis on set theory. Yeah, there was. They drew Venn diagrams. Yeah. Fine. But the math part of it was subsumed in the educational. The math learning was buried by the math education. And so it didn't work out. And I, as an instructional designer, I can certainly see, A, why those decisions were made, and B, why they failed. Now, I'm not sure that we're any smarter now about instructional design. Some of the early instructional designers were working in World War II. Edgar Dale. Jim. What's his name? He was here at UNC for a while. Anyway, those guys knew what they were doing. And these are the same guys who were part of the same cohort as Ed Begel and his group at Yale and later at Stanford to work on a elementary secondary school curriculum for mathematics. To put it in context, this whole thing started in about 58 as the result of Sputnik and the worry that the U.S. was falling behind in math and science, which should sound fairly familiar to anyone who's paying attention to the current educational magpies. STEM, science, technology, engineering and mathematics, and STEAM, science, technology, education, art, and mathematics, are both acronyms that are commonly used in National Science Foundation requests for proposal these days. But nobody really wants to talk about learning. They always want to talk about education. They want to talk about process of education. They don't want to really talk about learning. They want to have assessments that don't actually measure learning, in part because they all know that you can't measure learning. That's one of the problems with this whole business. You cannot measure learning. You can get an approximation, but it's not like you can stick a thermometer in somebody's mouth and find out, you know, what their body temperature is. At best, you can get an approximation of what their body temperature is, but it's accurate enough that if they have a fever, it will show up. If they have a core temperature problem, it will occur. Likewise, testing for learning is really difficult. It's much more difficult than measuring something like a thermometer for a body temp. Because the problem is confounded by the testing. So, do you know how to do this? Yes or no? There's been some tests done on street kids, I think in Brazil, Rio de Janeiro or someplace. Maybe Brazil, yeah, I don't know. But one of the South American countries, and I want to say it's Argentina, I want to say it's Brazil. And what they taught kids some basic math having to do with money. And then gave them a test, and they couldn't pass the test. But they put them out on the street and they can make change. Accurately. All the time. No question. Quickly. Why? Authentic tasking. The test was artificial. The test did not measure what they had learned. The test had no way of understanding what their cognitive processing was, because the test was the test. The test was not the doing. That's why performance is such an important component of any kind of assessment, and why performance is quite often overlooked, because performance is difficult to grade. I've probably used this example before, but it's an old joke about a guy comes out of a bar, finds one of his drinking buddies outside, down on the curb on his hands and knees, examining the concrete, examining the tar, looking at every little thing, and he says, "What are you doing?" He says, "I dropped my contact." "Oh, gosh, here, let me help you find it." So they both get down, and they get down on their hands and knees, and they scour the area, and they go back and forth, and they can't find it, and can't find it, and can't find it. And the guy says, "Jesus, you know, I'm not seeing your contact here. Are you sure you dropped it here?" The first guy says, no, I dropped it back in the alley, but the light's better here. That's what educational testing is doing. It's going where the light is, because that's where they can see. But it may or may not have anything to do with what's going on down the alley, which is what it's purporting to do. And that's the problem. That's where things fall apart. That's why all these high-stakes testing like NECAP and TCAP and all the rest of them. We used to have CSAP here, but they did away with that in favor of a new one that's supposed to be better, which probably isn't any more useful than the last one. Monk pole. So the challenge is, how do you measure learning? And the answer is performance. Now, the reality is that performance takes practice. Performance requires some authenticity. And while tests are purported to be authentic, the reality is they're not even close for the most part. Now, there's some tests that aren't too far off, some writing exams, for example. But a writing exam, a grammar exam that asks you to pick a definition or match up words in their definitions, or multiple choice, or even fill in the blank, which is marginally better, but still not great. Now, that's not performance. That's performance at the lowest level of Bloom's taxonomy. That's do you know the language? Do you know the do you have the nomenclature? It doesn't say whether or not you've got an understanding of the content in a way that would allow you to actually perform and use the content. So this issue is really important. And it's one of those things that I don't really see schools changing. But it was also one of the things that made this math textbook really different. The first unit was on deductive reasoning, and the first thing they had us do is do some deductive reasoning. How do you do deductive reasoning? And so they had us practice it. And they gave us some examples, some really easy ones to get the idea, and some really tough ones to see if we could apply them, the ideas. It was quite a challenge. I asked my daughter some of the questions today, and she was like, what? Yesterday. But the reality was, given a half a chance, she could do them. The one about the marbles she couldn't do. I'm not sure I could have done it at her age either. It was an interesting challenge for her to undertake, getting hit cold with these strange questions from her father. So anyway, education and learning. I'm working with Dan Sawyer right now. He's got it in his head that he wants to start some workshop sessions. He's been to Oregon. He's doing stuff with Dean Smith and Chris Rush. And they're doing some great stuff for professional authors. But a lot of people aren't at a point in their career where going to see Dean and Catherine is going to make any difference. I'm not sure what exactly a return trip to Oregon would do for me. I suppose it would really depend on the workshop. I'm almost tempted to sign up for the Character Voice and Setting workshop again. I know what it's involving. And the problem is I'm afraid he'd give out the same exact assignments, and that's not going to help me any. But I do have a standing invitation anytime I want to go back. You have to apply, and you have to be accepted. And on the basis of my last trip there, I've got a standing invite anytime I want to go. Pay the $600, I can go and spend a few days with Dean and Catherine. more like $1,000 by the time you add in the anchor in and all that. But still, it was and the airfare, $300 for car rental. It was an expensive trip. It was close to $2,000 in total. But that's the price of a good seminar. And much shorter. And I did get a lot out of it. And that one was based from an educational standpoint, to carry this riff forward a little bit. It really was based on performance. Can you do this? Here's the outline. Here's what you're supposed to do. Can you do it? Here's how it's supposed to look. Can you do it? And we were turned loose with our word processors to do it. And yes, apparently I could. I've been trying this new diet. I'm supposed to eat 30 grams of protein within 30 minutes of waking. I'm going to have to rethink this. This is the third day. And I have to say that I feel much better having a pretty heavy meal right after I crawl out of bed. And today was a problem because by the time I got it cooked and eaten, it was closer to 45 minutes to an hour. So I need to come up with some way to get my 30 grams of protein. They suggest homemade protein bars. But I have to say that the idea of making protein bars out of whatever it is you make protein bars out of, I'm assuming wheat germ and dietary supplements and protein powder and that kind of stuff. I'm assuming that's what it is. It doesn't really sound very appetizing to me. This week it's been beans and eggs. I made some chili early in the week, and it's mostly beans and a little bit of salsa and a little bit of chili beef, and poach a couple of eggs in it and eat it. And the chili warms up pretty quick, but it takes a while for the eggs to cook. It's very good. Gosh, it's delicious. All of the southwestern spices that I put in it, the chili powder and everything that goes in the chili, leaches into the eggs. And the yolk and the eggs makes the beans and chili a little extra rich. Now, my problem with this is that it seems like it ought to be pretty high in cholesterol. And that's another problem that I've got I need to deal with. We watched a show on TV last night called, what was it called? Eat Fast and Live Longer. And it was some guy, some Brit, who was talking about reduced calorie consumption, restricted calorie consumption, different ways of adjusting caloric intake in ways that will adjust blood chemistry. And far and away, the most effective one, based on the medical tests on his body, was a four-day fast. A four-day fast is like, holy crap, are you kidding me? So today's Thursday morning, I wouldn't eat. I wouldn't eat again until Monday morning. I would need again until Monday morning. Water and coffee. And he had a 25, or it was this soup mix. Ooh, 19 minutes on the second mile, I really did slow down. He had a soup mix, it was like 50 calories a day. Sort of a maintenance level to keep his body ticking over. But it did some astonishing things for his glucose and his cholesterol. But it was also very trying. The thought that you had to do that like every other month in order to keep the benefit up was a bit much. But he did have some other ideas, and I may investigate some of those as well. But 2 miles, 19 minutes on the second mile, not good, but at least I was out, I was walking. It's early yet, the day is still young. I have the Gangster in my word processor. I got a bunch of it done yesterday. I'm going to get a bunch more done today. But that's today. Tomorrow is another day. And with any luck at all, I'll talk to you then.